You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Good afternoon, everyone. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Stuart Somanlan, toko ingoa. Now, don't freak out. This is your Tuesday Wire. I'm here filling in for Mary Margaret today. I'll try and keep everything under control as best I possibly can. Helping me to steer the ship today, it'll be producers Ben and Justin in the studio at the moment. It's a full house, though. How's it going?
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's been exciting. I'm very excited about today's show.
Really?
Yeah, we wouldn't have known how to do this without you.
Oh. It's US midterm election day. How do you think that's all going to pan out?
Well, I'm going to think it's going to be exciting. It might be. It's very close for me.
And you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very close. And, well, to be honest, I don't really trust the polls over in the US, despite a lot of polls saying it's going to be a Democratic blue wave, because what happened in 2016.
Exactly.
I'm not going to. And a lot of polls, like Brexit, I'm not really trusting the polls anymore.
And the other big news, of course, the Spice Girls are reforming. Are we hyped?
Oh, yes, definitely. Who Good. Are we missing? Someone's
it's
missing
Posh.
That.
No,
it's
Posh
so
Spice.
Because I feel like she's not even that bad at singing.
Well, I don't know. I saw some people saying that she was basically a backup anyway, so... Okay. All right, coming up on the show today, it is a very green show. First up, Ben's talking to Brendan McIntosh from Beefy Green about the upcoming legalisation of hemp seed for human consumption. Then Ella's here with the Green Desk talking about the conservation genetics of threatened species. Plus, we'll have this week's edition of Under the Weather. After that, it's an international edition of Wire Worry Week. Justin's looking into the Yemen civil war. Then Ben speaks to GE Free NZ Secretary John Muller about their calls for the use of glyphosate-based herbicides in New Zealand to be reviewed. And lastly, in light of the New Caledonia independence referendum, Connor will be here to look at how France deals with its current and former colonies. Plus, don't forget to vote in our poll. It's on Twitter right now. And the question we're asking is, do you know the difference between hemp and marijuana? As always, hiaha o whakarou. Please get in touch. I want to know what you think about anything we're talking about on the show today, or really anything at all, to be honest. Tuku pātui mai. You can text us on 5395. Why am I? Give us a call on 309 3879. Or you can even tweet me at 95BFM News. I'd love to know your thoughts.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
So it's actually not legal to sell products containing hemp seed for human consumption in New Zealand. And you can produce and sell it for animal consumption, but not for people. But this is all expected to change in December, however, when law adjustments will likely make it legal to sell hemp products for people to consume. So I spoke to Brendan McIntosh, a pharmacist by trade, who with Brad Lake started Beefy Green, a company specialising in hemp protein powder, and they've recently won a Business Innovation Award for the company. We spoke a little bit about stigma, a move away from animal products to focus more on plant-based protein, and what upcoming law changes mean for hemp production in New Zealand. What was it about hemp that made you think we need to be producing hemp products?
As a pharmacist, been looking at supplements for sort of the last 10 years, and it wasn't until I went and did this postgraduate training in nutritional medicine that came to light the benefits of a plant-based diet. So then I was looking at importing pea protein from Europe, and then a med student actually told me about hemp, and yeah, didn't really want to be associated with it at the start, being a health professional and sort of the public perception around thinking it's marijuana. But I did look into its properties, and then yeah, once seeing the nutritional profile of the hemp seed, and it was just growing in our backyard, it was sort of a no-brainer.
So has it been frustrating not being able to sell your products for human consumption?
Yeah, it has been. Because we sort of started this time last year when they said the law was changing last November. But there was a bit of a confusion. They changed the Food Act then, which is what allowed Australia to start selling it, but then we've still got the Misuse of Drugs Act here, which has been holding us back.
Yeah, because it's been the Food Act, Misuse of Drugs, and the Medicines Act, right? What will that mean for your business when hemp seed can be sold as food, hopefully by December?
Myself and Brad have both still been working full-time in our normal jobs, But hopefully when that law changes, we'll be able to do some proper marketing and actually tell people the benefits to their own body, not just their pet.
Is Beefy Green encouraging people to move away from animal products, or is that just an added bonus of consuming hemp seed to get your daily protein?
A bit of both. We are trying to reduce the consumption of meat because I guess our modern diet has got way too much in it, and that's causing all the chronic diseases. So if we can reduce the amount of meat people eat but then increase the hemp, they're going to get all the nutritional benefits.
And you just won a competition for the most innovative food product on the market. What makes what you do really special?
Yeah, so we've sort of taken it, we've taken the hemp seed as it is. It's 43% protein, but we've actually added a few enzymes in it and taken the fibre out, and it's now up to 73% protein, soluble in water, so it dissolves in water, so we can directly compete with whey protein. And no one in the world has done that before.
When hemp is farmed on a decent scale, it leads to, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but bioremediation. Are you able to explain what that means and its benefits?
Yeah, bioremediation. That's more Brad's expertise, being a rural banker. But it just means that, like, something about nitrogen leaching in the soils and nitrogen fixing the soils.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've been in talks with Dairy NZ. A lot of the farmers are sort of struggling to meet these new standards. And planting hemp can actually help with that.
So you're a pharmacist. How beneficial has your expertise been in developing the Beefy Green products?
I think just from a sort of, I'm hoping that it has sort of changed public perception a bit, having a health professional tell people the benefits of it and do the actual research.
And looking at that, you know, have you come up against any stigma around hemp products since you've started selling them?
No. I mean, we've been going to the Christchurch Farmers Market since Queen's Birthday weekend, and everyone we've talked to, there's been no pushback saying this is not a good thing, sort of. But it is, a lot of people still think it's marijuana. There's still a lot of people saying, oh, will I get high off this? So there's still a lot of education to do around the differences.
And where are you sourcing the hemp seed from at the moment? Is that something you're doing yourself, or is that happening elsewhere?
It's all grown down in Mid-Canterbury, and we've just got contractors down there. But we're sort of ramping up for the law change. There's been over 300 times more hemp going to the ground this year than last year.
Oh, wow.
So it's, it's really sick to finally catch up on the rest of the world.
And what makes Canterbury a good place to be producing hemp seed?
I mean, the Canterbury Plains, the Canterbury is pretty well known for its crop growing ability. Everything just grows pretty well down here.
So in terms of people that do confuse hemp seed with marijuana, how would you like to describe hemp seed to those people?
So we say it's marijuana's cousin, doesn't have any THC, so there's no psychoactive component to it, purely just for its nutritional benefits.
Thanks for that, Ben. That was Brendan McIntosh from Beefy Green. It's actually something really interesting, something that I don't know a lot about. We're going to be talking about it in a sec. First up, though, we have had a text in on our most important news of the day. Someone has said, Posh Spice can't sing and is far from posh. What do we think about that?
I feel bad for her. Like, I think, you know, being a pop star, it's about image, isn't it? As much
exactly.
as anything else. And she looked the part. Looked the part.
All right, we're moving on to, we're going to keep talking about him, but it's time for
Freedom of speech, it means you have to listen to me.
It's time to have your say. Pole position on The Wire.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is a segment that you usually have midweek, but I thought why not. Our poll today on Twitter was, do you know the difference between hemp and marijuana? Do you guys know the difference?
Well, I actually do.
I had a good look
this morning. So for our listeners, cannabis is a plant that includes many species. So under that umbrella, you've got hemp and marijuana. Think of them like cousins.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a clue?
No, I thought that thanks to Ben. Well, the more you know. Exactly.
Well, the results of our poll, we had a phenomenal response, seriously. 14 votes. Thank you so much to the wonderful 14 of you who've got back to us. 71% of them reckon they did know the difference between marijuana and hemp. 29% no. I was certainly in that 29%. I didn't have a clue. We've had a text in saying, where does cannabis oil come into all of this? Cannabis oil? Isn't that, that's yeah, cannabis, right?
I didn't really look at that this morning. That might be something for another day. I don't want to like make a judgment on that today, but... Mm-hmm.
But basically, if it's marijuana, it's obviously illegal. If it's hemp, now it would be available.
Yes, for human consumption.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, it's interesting. So, basically, if you've got any more thoughts on this, please text us, and we're kind of out of... Is there anything more we need to say about this? Do we have any more hard-hitting discussion about hemp?
I feel good about where we're at with
All right, then. That was Pole Position.
It's called Democracy, sweetie. Look it up.
That was Pole Position on The Wire.
All right, thanks to everyone who gave us their thoughts on Twitter as well. And like I said, don't forget to text me on 5395 or give us a call on 309 3879. Someone has texted in to say that cannabis oil is a Class A drug. I'm going to take that as truthful. I don't know. I'm pretty uneducated. But I do want to know what you think about any of this, honestly, so please get in touch. It's time for a quick break now on The Wire. We'll be back in a sec with The Green Desk.
Thanks.
Fresh threads, brosif.
Ta.
Hock it up, my dude!
Yeah?
Digging your cool, quirky style.
Jeez, just buy your own BFM t-shirt. Come on!
Want to give so many compliments it hurts? 95BFM is back in the merch game, baby. And right in time for Christmas. You've got until November 18th to grab a classic BFM shirt, a classic BFM bag, or a super slick, one-off, never-to-be-repeated BFM tee designed by local ace artist Chippy. Don't miss out. Go to 95BFM.com/merch. Discount with your Simplicity B card, thanks to smashing promotions and good old mate Chippy.
This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
The Callaghan Medal is a New Zealand Communication Award given out annually for outstanding science or technology communication. Last month, it was announced that the award has been given to Dr. Helen Taylor, Research Fellow at the University of Otago. She was given the award in recognition of her excellent communication and outreach work related to her research in conservation genetics of threatened species. In an interview with Dr. Taylor, Alice started by asking her to explain what conservation genetics even means.
So conservation genetics is one of those things that people often don't put those two words together, conservation and genetics. But genetics is a tool that can be really, really important to conservation. So typically we're using it to look at what happens when populations get very small, how populations used to be connected but might not be anymore, and lots of other questions that we can answer that if you just look at species on the face of things, you can't always tell. But by sampling DNA and having a look at what's going on in that DNA code, we can answer a bunch of questions that you can't always get at without that data. So genetics is just a tool. It's just one of the tools that we can use to help threaten species, and conservation genetics is the field that aims to do that.
Mm. And what is your research specifically looking at?
So I do look at what happens to populations when they get very small, and I tend to look at that in threatened bird species here in New Zealand. So I worked with little spotted kiwi for my PhD, and I now work with South Island robins and also with hihi or stitch birds. And so I'm looking at when a population gets very small, it tends to lose genetic diversity, which is bad news because that means it can't adapt as well to changing circumstances. And we also tend to see more mating between relatives or inbreeding, and that can cause problems as well, like problems with reproduction, problems with survival. So at the moment, I'm actually looking at how inbreeding might be affecting male fertility in hihi and in South Island robin. So I actually look at their sperm to see what's going on with that in relation to the genetic data that we have for these species.
Has anyone done research like this previously with birds?
No, so there's a lot of data on inbreeding and male fertility in mammals and insects and plants, but very little on birds. There's a few small studies, but nothing of the scale that we're attempting here, and certainly no multi-species studies on wild populations. So this is all kind of new stuff.
I want to hear you talk about the Great Hehe Sperm Race.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was that about?
So the Great Hehe Sperm Race was an awareness-raising and fundraising initiative that I ran earlier in the year. So basically, as part of my research, I go out and I collect sperm samples from males, and I video the sperm swimming around under a microscope, and I measure how fast the sperm is swimming. And so in October last year, I went around 4 different populations of Hehe in the North Island, and I measured sperm swimming speed in 128 males. And one evening, I was sitting around with some of my co-workers on one of our field sites on Tiri Tiri Matangi, and we said, you know, we should bet on which bird is going to have the fastest swimming sperm. And then as we talked about it, we were like, well, actually, could we make this into something much bigger? And what we ended up doing was having a website built where anyone from the general public could place bets on which bird in my study that they thought would have the fastest swimming sperm. And each bet cost $10, and all of the money went to Hehe conservation. And it was one of those ideas where we weren't sure if it was just going to be a bit too weird to work, but in the end, it kind of went international. We got bets in from 17 different countries, and we raised over $11,000, so it worked really well.
How did you market that internationally? Or really at all? How did you get that out?
So I actually have a background in public relations. That's what I used to do before I went back into science. And so I put together a press kit with a press release and things like that and sent it out to New Zealand media. And we also did an awful lot of work on social media as well. And it was through social media, through Twitter specifically, that it mainly got picked up and then passed on to international journalists. There was one particular guy who writes for the BBC, for their world news pages online. He picked it up and ran with the story, and I think that got it out to a much wider audience. And then all of a sudden we were seeing news articles in Taiwan and France and Germany, and it was all over the place, which was super exciting.
Cool. Were you surprised when all of that was happening?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that it was possible that it was one of those ideas, because it was quite odd that it could kind of go a bit viral. But I never expected the kind of success. You know, when people said, well, how much do you think you're going to raise? And I was like, well, it's about 128 birds. If each bird gets one bet on it, that's $1,280. That would be nice, you know? Mm-hmm. I never thought we would break $10,000, let alone $11,000. So that was incredible.
When you were betting on birds, what kind of factors were you thinking about in terms of what birds you thought would be the fastest sperm?
So I didn't bet on any birds because I knew the answer.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have been allowed.
That's
However,
fair.
The kind of thing we'd be looking for, what we would expect to see, and the kind of hypothesis for what we're doing here in my study, is that birds with higher genetic diversity would have better sperm, better quality sperm. And so we'd expect, so Hehe, for example, they used to be all over the North Island, and then they got reduced to just one population on Hauturu, on Little Barrier. So that's the source population from which all other populations of Hehe have been founded.
Oh,
so you might expect that Hauturu would have the highest genetic diversity of any Hehe population, and that your fastest swimming sperm bird would be in that population. So that was one way to look at it. But because you're looking at it on an individual level rather than average level, it didn't actually work out like that. And the fastest, the bird with the fastest sperm actually came from Tiri Tiri Matangi, which is one of our translocated populations.
So when people were betting, were they able to see some kind of genetic profile for each bird?
No, because we didn't have it. So we've only literally just got the genetic data through for these birds. So what we did was we told them what population they came from, because some people, you know, like people who volunteered in certain sites, that population is just really special to them, so they just wanted to bet on the birds from there or whatever. But we also put up a little fun descriptor of each bird, although that was in no way, they were very jokey descriptors. They were in no way related to, you know, how whether we thought the bird would do well or not. It was all completely random. So it's kind of a bit of a lottery, really.
What is the ultimate goal of this research? How is what you're researching potentially useful for conservation?
So we have a fair number of problems with hatching success in birds in New Zealand. A lot of species of birds in New Zealand have been reduced down to very small numbers. And when we see issues with hatching success, it's not always clear whether that's to do with poor male fertility or developmental problems in the embryo or poor parenting. And so starting to pick that apart by asking in the first instance, well, can inbreeding cause poor male fertility in birds? That's the first step, sort of answering that question of why we have these issues with hatching success. So the first point of my research is to find out whether it does cause poor male fertility in birds, because it might not. And if it doesn't, fantastic, we can move on and answer the next question. But if it does, can we start to integrate that knowledge into conservation management and the way we translocate birds and move them around when we're thinking about founding new populations? You know, how should we best do that? So that's kind of the aim of what we're looking to do.
Does inbreeding affect female reproduction in any way?
So there's been way less work done on that, which is really interesting to me. And I think one of the reasons people don't study female fertility as much is because it's just much harder to get at. So, you know, like, we can take semen samples, we can look at sperm, but for most species, you know, that are internally fertilizing, you know, it's really hard to get at egg quality and things like that without having to euthanize the female, which, you know, we don't want to do when we're working with certain species. So I think it's just a much trickier question to get at. Okay, well, in birds, we assume that if the female is laying an egg, then she's fertile because she's made an egg. But is it a good egg? Is it a bad egg? Like, how do we tell the difference? If she's having issues, is that going to affect the quality of the egg? And there's just not a lot of work been done in that area at all.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
That was Dr. Helen Taylor speaking with Ella for this week's Green Desk. Some super interesting stuff in there. Thank you very much, Ella, for doing that piece for us. It's time now to wrap up what's going on in the ozone. It's Under the Weather.
Your weekly dispatch from the front line of the end of the world. Under the Weather with Ella Christensen.
Hello and welcome to Under the Weather. I'm your host, Ella Christensen, bringing you highlights from this week's climate, environment, and conservation news. All right, following up from last week's report about tropical cyclones, Typhoon Yutu made landfall in the Philippines on Tuesday. 15 people have been confirmed dead, mostly due to landslides, and dozens are missing. Landslides have caused a lot of damage after Yutu, cutting off at least one town. Last week, I talked about the destruction of the Mariana Islands because of Yutu. It's being predicted that the islands won't have power for several months at the very soonest. New South Wales in Australia had a heat wave this weekend, with a couple areas hitting above 40 degrees, breaking records for this time of year, yet again. Already, a bushfire southwest of Canberra has gotten out of control and is more than 100 hectares in size. This is the biggest of 17 fires currently burning in New South Wales. Queensland was also in the midst of a record-breaking heat wave last week. On the 28th, temperatures exceeded a 120-year record for October, with one town hitting 44 degrees. This was after 10 days of 40-degree temperatures in central Queensland. Last week in Italy, severe wind and rainstorms in the Dolomites killed more than 20 people. The winds were powerful enough to completely destroy thousands of hectares of forest. It's truly incredible for footage if you can look it up. Just hectares and hectares of massive trees absolutely razed. In some parts, they have fallen into the river, and the river is full to the brim with naked trees. 160,000 people lost power. Landslides damaged roads, houses, infrastructure. The fishing village Portofino, where millions of tourists visit every year, is now inaccessible. The main road has collapsed. On Monday of last week, Venice experienced incredible flooding and extreme winds of up to 180 kilometers per hour. Trees were uprooted. 75% of the city was underwater. Water reached 155 centimeters above sea level. I saw a video of people sitting and eating in a restaurant that was flooded up to their mid-calves. Everyone, including the servers in their fancy uniforms, was wearing knee-high plastic rain boots. The servers were carrying around trays of pizza, looking stone-faced as usual. If that isn't an image of the Anthropocene, I'm not sure what is. The Iberian Peninsula in Spain experienced heavy snowstorms, unseasonably cold temperatures, and then a tornado caused quite a bit of destruction on the island of Menorca just 2 days later. Almost the entire island was without power for at least a day. In Nigeria, 1.9 million people have been affected by severe flooding. Many of the states that have been impacted are crucial to agricultural production. The threat of a food crisis was so bad that the European Union donated 1 million euros to Nigeria in humanitarian assistance, which is totally unprecedented. Germany is dealing with the impact of drought conditions due to a dry and hot summer. 90% of the country has been impacted. In the last few months, there have been reports of huge masses of dead fish appearing along the banks of lakes and rivers. Now the inland shipping industry is freaking out because on certain waterways, barge transport is no longer possible. At some places along the Rhine, water levels are at the lowest they have ever been. Freight prices have shot up, and that is being felt by, quote, consumers, which is what apparently the new word for human beings is, in things like higher petrol costs. A new report released by the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, in which scientists from around the world compiled their monitoring data from the last 20 years, has concluded that population sizes of wildlife decreased by 60% globally between 1970 and 2014. Another way of saying this, as several news outlets used for their headline for the story, is humanity has wiped out 60% of global wildlife in the past 45 years. Ugh. The UN's biodiversity chief also said this week, unrelated to this WWF report, that we have 2 years to come up with a plan to save biodiversity and to avoid ecosystem collapse on a global scale, and then, yes, to avoid our own extinction. Given the next piece of news I'm about to share, this seems a bit unlikely. Finally, the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil. Terrible news in many ways. For the environment, here's what he plans: to take Brazil out of the Paris Agreement, to pave a highway through the Amazon, and to get rid of environmental laws. 12% of land in Brazil is set aside for indigenous people. This has been one of the few protections of the Amazon that has worked. Bolsonaro has said that when he becomes president, quote, there will not be a single square centimeter demarcated as indigenous land. He has also said that indigenous people want, quote, electricity, television, to date blonde chicks, and the internet. Did a shiver just go down your spine? Because it did for me the first time I read that. Indigenous people have had to fight to maintain their land rights and to have those rights respected. Bolsonaro has said, where there is indigenous land, there is wealth under it. I'm not sure what he means by wealth here, because a world without indigenous land is a world without humans, and a world without humans is a world without money. Ah, a world without money. That's a nice little fantasy to rest your anxious mind on for a moment. Am I right? So what can you do? This week, I suggest imagining yourself in one of the cataclysmic scenarios I've just told you about. Imagine how you would feel. Imagine how much it would mean if the people around you were able to be kind, generous, and patient in that scenario. Then start practicing that kindness, generosity, and patience right now toward every single person you meet, because that's literally the only thing that might save us. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Oh, yikes.
Under the Weather with Ella Christensen.
That was Ella with Under the Weather. We're going to take another quick break now. Remember, you can text us on 5395 or tweet me at 95BFM News. Or you can even call us. 309 3879 is the number. Honestly, I want to know your thoughts on literally anything. There is nothing that you could ring me or text me about that I would not want to know about, please. There's still a heap more to come on The Wire. We'll be back in a minute.
Got a Simplicity B card? Of course you do. Make the most of it by checking out the sweet discounts from our mates, including
Arcade, Fume, Lord of the Fries, Meze Bar, Mister's Cafe, Nice Touch Massage, Pat Menzies Shoes, Red Bar, and loads more.
Support independent media from as little as $4.20 a month with a Simplicity B card. For full discount info, go to 95bfm.com/bcardbenefits.
Cheer up. What are you even worried about? Do you believe in climate change or something? Everything's fine. Women can vote now. Hashtag feminism.
Concerned for the state of the world today? Want to shine a torch into the darkest crannies of current affairs? Every other week on The Wire is Worry Week, taking a topic of concern and digging in deep.
This week, anti-government movements.
Worry Week on The Wire, weekdays 12 to 1 every other week, with your rotating roster of hosts.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
That was quite an appropriately timed ad, wasn't it? This week for Why Worry Week, we are looking at anti-government movements. We're taking a pretty broad look at it as well. Justin's here now with a report looking into the Yemen civil war.
Yes, and the UN has called for the resumption of peace talks in Yemen last week as its civil war is now causing the world's worst humanitarian crisis at the moment. Here's some numbers. Half of the country's children under the age of 5 are malnourished, and a child dies every 10 minutes of preventable disease in Yemen. And I looked into the history of Yemen to find what caused the war, what happened since the war started in 2015. And at the end, I'm just going to talk a little about geopolitics that escalated the conflict. But now I'm going to start at 1990. The roots of Yemen's current civil war can be traced back to 1990, when North and South Yemen unified to form the Republic of Yemen. North Yemen, formed after the First World War, was a Shia-dominated state. It was founded after the Ottoman Empire collapsed in 1918, when Imam Yahya Muhammad declared the northern part of Yemen as an independent sovereign state, with Sana'a as its capital. South Yemen, on the contrary, was a protectorate of the British Empire since the 1870s because of its strategic location. The colony's capital was Aden, and it possessed natural ports to connect from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean. After South Yemen declared independence in 1967, it became a socialist state supported by the Soviet Union. However, the region was never stable, and a brief civil war broke out in 1986. After the reunification, Ali Abdullah Saleh from the north became the president and head of state of the new republic, while Ali Salim Al-Bid of the south became the vice president and the head of government. However, just 4 years after the reunification in 1994, a civil war broke out in Yemen.
But in 1993, Al-Bid quit the government and returned to the former southern capital of Aden, claiming that the new government was ignoring the needs of the south, in particular, its deep poverty. His attempt to secede from the Union failed at that point, forcing him to leave for Oman, where he stayed for many years.
Al-Bid became a leader in the Al-Harak, or Southern Movement, to demand Southern Yemen to be seceded from the Republic and become an independent state. This is him talking in 2012.
You have long called for secession, you worked for secession, and you fought for secession. Do you think that you can achieve this goal? How realistic is it?
I prefer to answer in Arabic so that I can express myself exactly.
With respect to the current status of the uprising in southern Yemen, the peaceful protests, I joined the movement there in 2008. Since then, I've been working with my fellow Yemenis inside Yemen and abroad to take it to another level. I believe we are advancing as we are working with all our fellow citizens there to keep this up. This peaceful uprising, I want to say, represents a huge popular movement, and it embraces the whole political spectrum, covering all the areas of the occupied South Yemen.
Saleh continued to consolidate his power after winning the brief civil war in 1994. In 1999, the Yemeni parliament passed a law extending presidential terms to 7 years and create a 111-member presidentially appointed council of advisors with legislative power. But the troubles in Yemen continued. Its Human Development Index has continuously been the bottom of not only Asia, but the world. It ranked 178th out of 189 in the 2018 index, just above other states such as South Sudan and the Central African Republic. Government corruption was also not uncommon then. The region also cannot resolve armed conflicts as it need to combat South Yemeni separatists, terrorist cells such as Al-Qaeda and Shia rebels called the Houthis. And then the Arab Spring caught up in 2011, shortly after Tunisians overthrew President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and ending his 24-year regime. Major protests happened in major Yemeni cities such as Sana'a and Aden, demanding governmental changes. Saleh initially refused to hand over power, and government forces opened fire at unarmed demonstrators at Sana'a in March, killing at least 52 people. But after an assassination attempt in June, which bombs exploded in the presidential compound. The attacks killed four bodyguards and caused Saleh burns and shrapnel injuries. After going to Saudi Arabia to receive treatment, he resigned and ceded power to Vice President Abdrabba Mansour Hadi in February 2012. But during the power vacuum of the transitional period, other parties were slowly taking control. The Houthi rebels had already taken control of most northern Yemen between 2012 and 2014, with forces loyal to Saleh, who reportedly wanted to return to power by aiding his once enemies. In September 2014, the Houthis attacked and occupied Sana'a, forcing Hadi to form a government with them. But the government didn't last long, as the Houthis and Saleh loyalists launched a coup in January next year, seizing the presidential palace and military bases. Hadi fled and moved the capital south to Aden, and the rebels also advanced south and reached the outskirts of Aden in March. After the fall of Sana'a and pro-Hadi forces losing the battle for Aden, nearby Saudi Arabia assembled a coalition with other Gulf states and the West to launch airstrikes against the rebels in April. Government security forces retook full control of Aden in July and since then started to counterattack the rebels aided by coalition airstrikes. However, these airstrikes were criticized for targeting schools, hospitals, and markets, causing many civilian and aid worker deaths.
The images disturbing and heartbreaking. Children pouring into a hospital, most of them under 10 years old, still wearing their backpacks and school uniforms covered in blood. After their school bus was hit by a bomb, a crater at the site of the airstrike, the smoke from the blast visible from miles away. Tonight, at least 29 children returning from a school picnic among the dozens killed.
All opposing sides in the Yemeni conflict had been notified of the hospital's location. But on Monday, an airstrike believed to have been launched by the Saudi coalition killed several and wounded over a dozen people in the northern Hajar province. Witnesses say the doctors were unable to run for cover and evacuate the wounded. As warplanes hovered overhead, they feared more bombings. The hospital was run by Médecins Sans Frontières staff. The aid group says it's the fourth such attack against their facilities in less than a year.
The airstrikes also destroyed Yemen infrastructure, water and sanitation systems, causing an outbreak of cholera in 2016, affecting more than 600,000 people. Saleh himself returned to Sana'a after announcing a formal alliance with the Houthi rebels in July 2016. But the alliance broke down in late 2017 and Saleh publicly declared a split in the 2nd of December and expressed openness to hold talks with the Saudi-led coalition. 2 days later, he was killed in Sana'a trying to flee to Saudi-controlled territory. His vehicle was ambushed and disabled by a rocket-propelled grenade and he was shot by a Houthi sniper. Like nearby Syria and Iraq, the conflict in Yemen is another pawn of geopolitics in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran. But currently, 22 million people are a direct result of the conflict as famine, cholera broke out with very few humanitarian supplies coming in because the ports are either destroyed or not allowed into Yemen by the coalition-led blockades. Yes, and going a little bit more on the geopolitics, the Houthi rebels are backed by Iran, while maybe I should start by mentioning all the countries in, such as the Saudi Arabia, Iran, or America have interests in Yemen. But I'll start with the Saudi Arabia and Iran. So Saudi Arabia doesn't like Iran because Iran itself was founded on an Islamic revolution. And basically what happened in Iran in the 1950s is Muslims overturning the Shah, that is the king in Iran, and forming an Islamic republic. And because Saudi Arabia is governed by a king, and they obviously don't want a republic or such a movement to happen, a revolution, so they always try to do anything to curb Iran's power, and that included aligning themselves with the US. And what happened in Yemen, Iran is backing the Houthi rebels who are overthrowing the Haiti government in Aden. And yeah, and the Saudis don't really want a country just south of their territory to be controlled by an Iranian proxy. So that's why when the Haiti government is so near to its downfall during the Battle of Aden, it sends collision. It assembled a collision and used airstrikes to help the government, to help government security forces to push back. And yeah, and basically the US is involved in this as well because it is one of the strongest allies of Saudi Arabia since after the Second World War, and it sold so many weapons to them, including fighter jets, or even using refueling planes to help refuel Saudi bombers to continue their airstrikes. So like I said at the end of my story, the Yemeni war, the civil war, is just basically a pawn of the geopolitics, and 22 million people are now suffering because of it.
Cool, thank you for that. We've had a tweet in saying the brutal genocide through artificial famine being perpetrated in Yemen is one of the most atrocious crimes of the 21st century. What would you say to that? Do you think that's a fair analysis?
Well, now the coalition say they are bombing those ports and stuff, and it's posing a blockade because of tactical reasons, but yeah. The tweet might give some sense because, mm-hmm. yeah, it does block the supplying of humanitarian aid into Yemen, especially North Yemen, because the rebel-backed areas are now completely blockaded and there's no way of aid going through.
All right. Thank you very much, Justin.
Worry Week on The Wire.
That was Wire Warrior Week for this Tuesday. Ben, what have you got for us next?
Well, GE Free New Zealand disappointed with the Environmental Protection Agency for not reassessing the use of glyphosate-based herbicides in New Zealand. And for reference, products like Roundup, GBHs. So according to GE Free NZ, it appears these products have become almost so useful it's impossible to ban them. I asked GE Free Secretary John Muller why New Zealanders should be concerned about GBHs.
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. As alluded to in our press release, Roundup is one example of a glyphosate-based herbicide, which we call GBH. So the active ingredient is glyphosate, and that's the most common form, but there are many other commercial forms of glyphosate. And it's not just the glyphosate that is the issue, because principally that's been tested in this particular testing by Ms. Temple, or the EPA Temple report, but it's the adjuvants or the additives that haven't been tested, and it's considered that they are many times more hazardous than just the glyphosate itself, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And so there's a lot of unknowns, and that they should be tested.
Does that come down to companies adding extra stuff? Because I know the release mentions that many companies are making their own glyphosate formulations that don't get proper approval. Is that a situation that's getting a bit out of control?
Yes. Well, I mean, there's no regulation of that, and we don't know what's in the what they call adjuvants or additives. So it's an unknown which is, you know, and you get these, with any chemical, you get various synergistic or antagonistic effects, you know, that will occur, and it's just not known. So to be authentic, you really need to test those additives as well as glyphosate. So that's one of the big things. And of course, the other thing that we've alluded to there is the court case in America where Dwayne Johnson was awarded a large sum of money for his cancer, which they've connected it to glyphosate. And the Monsanto papers, which were brought out in the court case, showed that, in fact, glyphosate had never really been properly tested. That's just glyphosate itself. It had never really been properly tested for safety by Monsanto. And anyone who had come up with any research, like the International Cancer Research Organization, were vilified. So those two things together indicate that proper research has not been done on the safety of glyphosate or the adjuvants at all.
So in early 2000, there was one registered GBH formulation, right? And now there are 91 registered formulations. Why do you think GBH began being used? They started using it to such a large extent.
Well, then it's used widely in initial settings and also parks and so on, although some places do use alternatives like steam treatments and the like. But, I mean, it's a very popular herbicide. It you know, and spray it on, and 2 weeks later, everything's yellow and dead. It's quick and easy, but so of course companies will take, once that patent came off, then that's sort of a commercial possibility. So that's why it's you know, there's so many different GBH formulations, because glyphosate, you know, it is highly effective in terms of killing weeds, but in terms of its health effects and the fact that it stays in the environment, the water, air, soil, bodies, then that's a whole other issue. Because the use, I mean, it just keeps expanding, you know, exponentially, the use commercially in public areas or residential areas.
Do you think GBH formulations are creeping into New Zealand's food supply?
Well, again, that would be great to test it. Overseas, I mean, in the States, they've just recently tested a whole lot of children's breakfast cereals. And that one recent one, they found that there was more glyphosate than vitamins in this is children's breakfast cereals. They found it in mother's breast milk, they found it in water, they found it in, you know, it's ubiquitous basically. And I mean, that's the States where it's heavy use, but I don't see any difference here, because it's every farmer's choice chemical plus home gardener and so on, you know. And it's I wouldn't be at all surprised, and particularly on things like bread, wheat-based products, oats and the like, because they spray glyphosate or Roundup based products, GBH products, over crop just before harvesting to desiccate it. So, of course, that's absorbed into it quite substantially. So that would be a good start.
Okay, and finally, what are the primary things that GE-Free NZ believes needs to be changed when it comes to the use of GBH products in New Zealand?
Well, I think the first thing is that, you know, we need to properly assess it for safety, and not just the glyphosate, but these adjuvants. We need to really do a proper independent test without any industry involved, you know, that needs to be totally independent. And I think we need to start looking at the way we grow our food and utilise these chemicals and have a broad look at the whole thing. So that's the first thing, is really a proper safety assessment, which hasn't been done.
That was Ben speaking to GE Free New Zealand Secretary John Muller. Connor's here now. What's going on?
Yep, so New Caledonia is just voted for an independence referendum to remain with France after 20 years of kind of deliberating over how they were going to do a referendum, how they're going to reconcile the nationalist and pro-French sides in the country. You know, this is a country like New Zealand that's had a long history of colonial oppression, seen the indigenous Kanaks have their land, their resources seized and confiscated and given to French settlers, and kind of leaving them as a kind of very, very poor section of society with very little kind of a political voice. However, what I'm going to do is, because interestingly enough, France did not do what the UK did with their colonies, where they kind of devolved them into these autonomous things and gradually gave them sovereignty, and then, you know, now they're sovereign states. They never had that ambiguity under the crown, so because they were a republic. So they, all their colonies were either intrinsically part of France, given referendums, or they were kind of pressured into giving them independence during the kind of decolonization period of the 60s and 70s. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at France's relationship with their former colonies and current colonies, and particularly going to look in at Africa, because that's where the biggest disputes are. I'd love to go into nuclear testing in French Polynesia. I'd love to go into the riots in Martinique and Guadeloupe. I'd love to go into the space testing and the clearing of jungles and indigenous tribes in French Guiana, but I literally do not have time to do that, which is a shame. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about France-Afrique, which is a policy that the French government have towards their former colonies in Africa. So France was always reluctant to let go of its colonies after years of kind of having an imperial inferiority complex towards the UK. They always wanted to compete with empire, but their empire was never quite as big as the UK. So even though much of Africa went independent, France still very much has its finger in the economic pie over there, so to speak. So France adopted this policy called France-Afrique towards Africa, where they let the countries go independent but still had first dibs on resources there, and kind of unofficially reserved the right to overthrow rulers they don't like very much that threaten their economic interests. So it kind of started in a positive sense in the 60s under Charles de Gaulle, infamous French president that he was, with the independent leader of the Ivory Coast called Félix Houphouët-Boigny, and this was actually a term coined by Boigny himself because he saw his country's development as only being possible through economic partnership with France. Now, this kind of worked out for the Ivory Coast itself. I mean, the Ivory Coast has a very good relationship with France; it's very equal. They trade. The Ivory Coast is now one of the richest, fastest developing countries in Africa, despite all the civil wars they've gone through in the last few years, which is kind of amazing. This kind of got transitioned into something that was quite neo-colonial. So it's why it's not uncommon if you look at French media to see pictures of Hollande or Macron or even former President Sarkozy standing next to authoritarians like Paul Biya of Cameroon, Denis Nguesso of the Congolese Republic, or Omar Bongo of Gabon. And the opinion of the policy has been mixed. Some see the interventions as being, such as in North Mali, as key to regional stability, where the French essentially fended off ISIS in the Sahara Desert, which kind of stopped Mali from turning into an Islamic caliphate, which was, that was something that was generally supported regionally and in France. But others see it as basically encouraging dictators and, basically saying to dictators that you can abuse your power and your people and your country's funds just as long as you let our oil companies, Elf, Total, and Total, get access to your oil reserves and let France have full access to gold, minerals, diamonds, etc., etc. So it's very controversial at the moment that is in France as a form of neo-colonialism, and particularly now that there's always controversy when those dictators come to France and kind of live it up with the president, get invited to state dinners, etc., etc., because it's still seen as it brings back memories for the French people of Paris being this kind of haven for African authoritarians to live it up and spend their country's funds that they've embezzled on posh sort of, apartments and stuff. So what has France done to amend that? They've done this policy called bien mal acquis, which translates to ill-gotten goods. So they've actually started prosecuting African dictators who have got assets they've embezzled hidden away in metropolitan France. And they've confiscated and prosecuted them under French law. Best example is Teodoro Obiang of Equatorial Guinea had two Parisian apartments, three Bugatti Veyrons, and three Ferraris, all purchased on state funds, stolen from him. Just kind of round that policy off, because it's still ongoing and it's still sort of it's still ongoing, but it's very much more under the radar than it was under, say, Charles de Gaulle or François Mitterrand, where you still have instances like African Francophone soldiers marching with French troops in Paris on Bastille Day. That happened 5 years ago. You still have Elf and Total that have massive reserves in the Congo that they aren't going to give up. And the French have intervened 30 times so far since decolonization in West Africa. And it doesn't seem like they're going to stop. Whenever anyone pulls them up on it, and it has been pulled up in the General Assembly, those are the only times France uses its General Security Council veto. So, yeah, France, in light of this, is you got to kind of keep an eye on them because, you know, their neo-colonial policy is very under the radar, but it is definitely still there. And so in the context of New Caledonia and the other kind of territories in the Pacific, just watch and see what they do, yeah, is what I'll say. Because, yeah, they still are engaging in some pretty, not cool stuff in Africa and abroad. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Connor.
No worries.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed your Tuesday Wire. That's all the time we've got. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope I've done all right job filling in. It's been my pleasure. A huge thanks to my producers, Ben, Justin and Connor, and of course Ella with the Green Desk. Plus a big hand to our wonderful news director, Lillian Hanley. On the show today, we had Brendan McIntosh, Dr. Helen Taylor and John Muller. If you like what you've heard today, all of our news content is available online at 95bfm.com/bcasts. And don't tune out just yet. There's a whole lot more BFM coming up next. It's time for The Wonderful with Gin. Mary Margaret will be back with you next week. In the meantime, I've been Stuart Somerlund. Goodbye.
Was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.